cash, every movie costs $2,184.
Hello and welcome to Backtracks Theme Music. My name is Corey Morissette, joined as always by John Marietto. How's it going tonight, John?
Oh, it's so good. You know, you and I sometimes, we've seen a lot of the same movies, but sometimes we see movies that one of us hasn't seen. And that's not the case tonight. Like, I had seen this movie, but so long ago, it probably doesn't count because the human body generates cells every 7 years. And I'm probably like five lifetimes away from when I saw this movie.
Well, I got a feeling tonight, John, is tonight what it means to be young. And only because joining us once again is our good buddy, Jeff Saunders. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing great. John may have seen this movie before, but I had never heard of this movie.
Well, you're a little young. Now, this movie came out in 1984. It was a big soundtrack for me. I remember 1984, my sister and I think we're on a trip to Minot, North Dakota. And we each bought a record. And I bought Dare to Be Stupid by Weird Al Yankovic. And she bought the soundtrack to Streets of Fire. And I'm pretty sure I wore that out on her. I think I listened to that more than I did Dare to Be Stupid. To me, this is a perfect soundtrack for me. I loved everything about it. I was listening to the soundtrack before I even saw the movie. And then I saw the movie, which is a neo-noir rock fable. Which is just absolutely amazing. And I watched the hell out of this in the 80s. And I hadn't seen it in a great many years. And John actually rewatched it before I got to this past weekend. And I'm just like, please tell me it holds up. Please tell me it holds up. And then I went and saw it. And to me, it absolutely holds up. We're talking about Streets of Fire, directed and written by Walter Hill of 48 Hours fame, starring Michael Paré, who at the time was supposed to be the next big thing. In movies, he was just coming off Eddie and the Cruisers, another movie we desperately have to do on this show. It also starred an 18-year-old Diane Lane, Rick Moranis, Amy Madigan, William Dafoe, just a tremendous cast, and about as 80s a movie as you can get. And John is already wagging his finger. What do you got, John?
So one of the smaller actors in this movie that you're missing is Rick Rossovic.
Yes.
Right? And Rick Rossovic, you might not know this by name, but you have seen him. And I'm talking to all the listeners out there right now in so many things. He has a small role in The Terminator after this, but you would really know him as Slider from Top Gun. Mm-hmm. He reprises that role in Maverick.
He doesn't. Rick Rossovic is not in Maverick.
He's not in Maverick?
No.
Oh, are you fact-checking me now?
Yes, I am, because I watched Maverick like 2 days ago. He's not in it.
He's in the first one.
He is in the first one.
He's also in Roxanne.
Yes. He's great in Roxanne. Yep.
He's so great in Roxanne, right? Yeah, no, I stand corrected. He was not in Maverick. His last movie was 2016. He should have been in Maverick.
He needs to get more work. Rick Rossovic, another guy who was supposed to be absolutely huge in the 80s and kind of fell off the face of the earth, much like Michael Paré, who did Eddie and the Cruisers, then this one, which bombed, unfortunately. And then he did a movie called The Philadelphia Story. I don't know if you ever saw it. I think it's kind of the story of the atomic bomb, which now Christopher Nolan is taking on in his new movie Oppenheimer, coming out summer 2023. But after that, Michael Paré did a lot of movies and horseshit.
Is actually the Philadelphia Experiment.
Oh, and thank you.
It's about the Philadelphia Experiment where they made a battleship disappear and go into the future and then come back.
Wow, I was way wrong.
And it really happened.
Well, I haven't seen that movie since 1984, as you could tell, because I didn't even look it up. I thought I knew what it was about. Turns out, nope. Completely wrong.
I am so glad Jeff just corrected you on something right now.
Can we correct Jeff on something now?
We're going to have to. He'll give us plenty of opportunities.
I feel like you're setting the bar awfully low.
All right. So real quick, let's give initial impressions on the movie. John, you said you saw this movie a long time ago, kind of forgot about it. What were your initial impressions of Streets of Fire?
This is a quintessential 80s action movie. Everything that I want when I hear those words are in this movie. You know, questionable acting balanced with some actually really solid performances, right? Some very questionable gang costumes and costumes in general. I question what we consider the tough look in this movie, and the punker look in this movie is really 80s questionable.
You know what? It reminded me. I don't know about you. It reminded me a lot of the Blue Oyster from Police Academy.
Well, but I'm not just talking about that. Michael Paré is basically Patrick Swayze playing the main character in River the House in this movie, right? Like, they're basically the same character. He's like, he can beat anybody up, but doesn't really look the part until he can beat anybody up. But his outfit is basically a Henley shirt, a pair of Cavariccis. I don't believe he's wearing socks in any scene. And his pants are short enough where you can tell he's not wearing socks. And he's wearing the narrowest suspenders I've ever seen. And they're not like traditional like spandex suspenders. They're like this leather, weird looking, like he almost like what you'd see a cowboy in the Wild West wearing suspenders. Nothing in his outfit has aged well at all. I don't think it aged well when he was wearing it.
He looks like he's cosplaying as Judd Nelson from The Breakfast Club. Right.
A little bit. Suspenders are very big in the universe of Streets of Fire. And just to give you some context, it's not really set in any sort of time. They bill it as a rock and roll fable. Imagine the 1950s stayed popular throughout the decades. It definitely has a 1950s aesthetic to it. And John talking about, you know, there being a Western feel of the outfit, it's because Michael Paré's character, Tom Cody, is basically the man with no name. He's the gunslinger who rolls into town, saves the damsel, and then rides away at the end, right? He's Mad Max. He's that kind of character. The aesthetic of this movie is one of my favorite things about it, including the costumes. And yeah, suspenders are huge. Willem Dafoe plays the villain of the movie, Raven. He's wearing like leather pants with leather suspenders. Like, everybody's wearing suspenders in this thing. That's one of my favorite aspects of the movie. But again, it's not a certain time period. It's they, you know, Star Wars was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. This is billed as another time, another place. It's definitely a different universe. Jeff, what were your initial thoughts watching Streets of Fire?
Well, okay, there are a ton of elements in this movie that I love and adore. It looks really good on paper, but you're gonna have to queue up. The Dream Is Over, my friend.
Wrong show.
the movie as a whole didn't really work for me, but I like I said, I love and adore most of the parts that make up the movie, if that's possible. And what you were saying about Another Time, Another Place, they actually, I was reading on their wiki that was kind of inspired by George Lucas.
Yeah.
Setting Star Wars like a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. So I love that. I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
And
I think
I think the costumes are cheesy, like in the best ways. But some of the acting fell a little short. And I think that I think a lot of that just had to do with a lot of these guys were still really young and maybe hadn't quite peaked or plateaued as actors yet.
Well, and the mantra from Walter Hill and the casting director was nobody over 30. They were very much inspired by John Hughes and Steven Spielberg. Both were huge in the mid-80s, right? And they said, you know, Spielberg never cast anybody over 30. John Hughes never cast anybody over 30. We're doing the same thing. So like you said, Jeff, they're all incredibly young. And even Michael Paré, not the best actor. I'll definitely agree with you guys there. But, you know, Rick Moranis playing an asshole I thought was kind of fun. Diane Lane, like one of her first big roles. Everybody's kind of playing kind of the same attitude throughout the whole film, just kind of angry and grumpy. But you know, I kind of dug that.
I will say that this movie accomplishes one thing I didn't think was possible. It turns Rick Moranis, one of the most likable human beings on the planet, into a creep. And I think it's a credit to him that he pulls this performance off in this movie. And when I said there was a balance of like so-so acting with some pretty spectacular acting, I was specifically thinking of Rick Moranis and his spectacular acting in this movie. Because for him to play this role this way is not a role I would have ever cast him in, and he nails it.
Absolutely. And one of my favorite stories from the making of Streets of Fire is the first time Rick Moranis met Michael Paré. Michael Paré, not a classically trained actor. He was just coming off Eddie and the Cruisers, which is kind of a mid-range hit. But he met Rick Moranis and just wanted to beat the fuck out of him. He hated Rick Moranis because Rick Moranis is a comedian. He's kind of a smart ass. Like, so, Michael Paré, are you naturally a tough guy or are you just putting on a role type thing? And Paré was like, I just want to beat the shit out of this guy because I hate him. But he couldn't because he wanted to get the job. So Michael Paré had to kind of put up with it. Not a guy with a huge sense of humor, I'm gathering, Mr. Paré is. But I just really enjoyed that story of Michael Paré, who actually said Rick Moranis is a fucking dweeb. He couldn't get laid in a whorehouse with a fistful of 50s. And he's trying to, give me shit. He's one of those types. Whereas we all know Rick Moranis as being a Canadian treasure.
He was making fun of the guy from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, who hadn't made that movie yet, but would soon.
He's making fun of the guy from SCTV.
Seymour from Little Shop of Horrors.
I know, right? It doesn't make
Well,
sense.
I think at this point, Rick Moranis already was a treasure.
Oh, absolutely. In Canada, especially from SCTV, right? He was one of the McKenzie brothers. He's Bob McKenzie for crying out loud. Or Doug. I can't remember which one he was. He's one of those two.
Yeah, his star hadn't really hit huge yet in the United States. I believe that happens 2 years later with Little Shop of Horrors. It's really,
Ghostbusters as well in 80, was
oh
that
yeah,
84? Yeah.
well, Ghostbusters, he becomes recognizable, but he doesn't star in, right? Like he's to a degree steals a movie. It's tough to steal a movie from Bill Murray at the height of his powers, right? But he makes enough of a name for himself that he gets to Little Shop of Horrors. That's really where he becomes a household name.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about the soundtrack now. This is kind of what I wanted to talk about this movie for. I love this soundtrack so much. I never get tired of any of these songs. Such an eclectic soundtrack, very much very Meatloaf sounding. And there's a reason for that. It's because Jim Steinman actually wrote two songs on this soundtrack. Tonight Is What It Means to Be Young, and the song we're doing tonight, Nowhere Fast. But it also includes contributions from Stevie Nicks, who wrote the song Sorcerer, which was performed by Marilyn Martin. The Fix have a song called Deeper and Deeper. The Blasters, if anyone knows the Blasters, they're just a band I'm kind of getting into now. An old-time American rock band, kind of got a Stray Cats feel to them. They perform a couple of songs, One Bad Stud and Blue Shadows. Tom Petty and Benmont Tench, Kevin Brown, if you're listening to this, they wrote a song for the Streets of Fire soundtrack called Never Be You, performed by Maria McKee. And Ry Cooder, who did the score, has a song on here called Hold That Snake. And Dan Hartman had the big single from this soundtrack in 1984. It was a huge song called I Can Dream About You, which was performed by the Sorrells in the film, which I don't know if you guys recognize some of the actors in the Sorrells, but Michael Eddie T. Williams from Forrest Gump, he was in the Sorrells. One of the cops from Die Hard, one of the Johnson agents from the FBI, he was in the Sorrells. Like, pretty good pedigree on this soundtrack.
Robert Townsend was in there.
Yes, he was. What did you think of the music, Jeff?
I loved it. I mean, I like 80s rock, and like you were saying, the soundtrack to this was very eclectic, but it kind of matched like the look and feel of the movie, like really, really well. Because the movie kind of felt like a whole bunch of like weird but good things all crammed together and put on the screen. So the soundtrack definitely meshes well with that. And it also felt like there was almost constantly music playing during the movie. Like I can't really remember very many times in the movie where there's just dialogue or just quiet. There's almost always like some rock music going in the background.
And that's thanks to Ry Cooder. Actually, you guys know composers. Does anyone know who the original composer hired for Streets of Fire was? He's kind of famous. He's done some big movies. Not John Williams.
I don't know. I know that I know a rock and roller that they were going to use a song from. Is that who we're talking about?
Nope.
Nope. Okay.
I'm thinking specifically of a film composer who had actually written a score for Streets of Fire that they turfed and got Ry Cooter instead. John, any guesses?
I want to say Jim Steinman from Meatloaf.
Well, he wrote two of the songs, but he did. He wasn't hired to do the score.
He would have killed on this.
He might have. But actually, it was James Horner, composer of Titanic and Apollo 13 and films like that.
But not yet.
Not yet, no. But I thought Ry Cooter did great. And actually, the song we're talking about, Nowhere Fast, the beginning of the film, and I know John has thoughts on the beginning of the movie, has a great, it kind of keeps that drum beat from Nowhere Fast, but Ry Cooter's laying some cool guitar on it as Tom Cody's coming into town. And then it just kind of seamlessly meshes into Nowhere Fast, written by Jim Steinman, of course, is the writer of Bat Out of Hell 1 and 2, and performed by what's billed as Fire Inc., which is really just two, they melded two female voices together, Lori Sargent and Holly Sherwood, to create the vocals for Ellen Aim, because the whole plot of the movie is Ellen Aim and the attackers are performing at a club. Ellen Aim gets kidnapped by a gang, and her old boyfriend Tom Cody comes to town and tries to rescue her. And that leads us into the beginning of the song here. What do you say, guys? You ready for a little Nowhere Fast from Fire Inc.?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Here we go.
So I don't know if you'd call this pop rock or synth rock or piano bar rock, but this movie is to this kind of rock the way the movie The Last Dragon is to 80s dance club music, right? It is exactly what you picture. If I go to an 80s rock bar, this is the kind of music I'd picture them playing, right? And it's kind of, in other movies, there's a more generic version of this. This feels very identifiable to this particular movie. But I really, the vibe of the music going into the movie set the tone for how much I was going to enjoy the rest of the movie.
How did you like the rest of the movie?
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Young Willem Dafoe lays the groundwork for what he's going to do the rest of his career. In so many great and wonderful and creepy and over the top ways. He's wearing some kind of weird, I don't want to call it weird, but really out there S&M gear as the gang leader. And his fight with Michael Pare at the climax of the movie is the stuff of choreography legend.
That's amazing.
It is certainly something. I think it was kind of like a vinyl or pleather butcher's apron.
Yeah, in a way, with suspenders. Don't forget, those are huge in this universe. But
big fat ones.
To me, this screams Meatloaf. And like you said, 80s Meatloaf, because it's kind of got a Bat Out of Hell vibe to it. But yeah, it's the electronic drums that kind of bring it right into the 80s. And the band, The Attackers, were actually a real-life band called Face to Face, who were bandmates of Lori Sargent, who provided the lead vocals on this song, Nowhere Fast. And I loved them in the movie because the drummer, even though he's playing on a traditional acoustic kit and not an electric kit, is just fucking wailing it. And they all got their hair done up like greasers, and they're performing the background just perfect. And I usually don't like when actors lip sync to other people singing. It usually comes off kind of goofy. But I thought Diane Lane did a pretty good job acting and lip syncing as Ellen Aim. What did you guys think?
Go ahead, John.
No, you go first, Jeff. You were the one.
I was just going to say, I thought it was Diane Lane until I started looking up the facts.
Anytime Diane Lane has been on the screen in her career, from Cherry and the Outsiders on, I have been all over her as an actress, as a crush, and everything in between. And that doesn't change in this movie. Diane Lane shines on the screen. She is a true movie star. She might be lip syncing. It doesn't matter. I am cheering her on. I am hoping that, like, it's a very weird kidnapping plot, and I can't really tell at the beginning of the movie if Michael Paré is in it for the money or if he's in it to, like, save her. There's some ambiguity going on with what his motives are early on. By the end of the movie, he comes around. But, yeah, she shines in this movie.
Absolutely. And I can help you out with the Michael Paré thing. I think a lot of it stems from the fact that he's not a very good actor. I don't know if you guys picked up on that vibe, but how many times is he just looking like a dead fish and yelling at somebody? It's like, you're not emoting, but you're yelling. It was weird.
I feel like we're going to keep coming back to that.
You go hard on this podcast, Corey. Like, you better hope Michael Paré never listens to it.
Because he will kick my ass. If you wanted to beat the fuck out of Rick Moranis, he will kill me.
What do you think of Amy Madigan as McCoy, like the former army, like randomly, like, I've shot guns before character?
You know, originally that was supposed to be a male character. It was called like Menendez or something. He's supposed to be like a Mexican character, but Amy Madigan was reading for the sister role, Reva, and she went to Walter Hill and said, I really would rather be this character. He thought, oh, that's kind of cool, have a woman in that role. And I thought she was fine. She's a very good actress. I love her. Field of Dreams is one of my favorite movies, and she's perfect in that film. But here it's everyone's just kind of playing that one note throughout the entire thing. No, there's no arcs anywhere in this film at all.
No. Michael Paré is playing Tom Cody, who I know he predates it, but he's Bargain Basement Dalton. Right, yep. Like I thought you'd be taller, but Dalton has so many more layers, and so much more nuance that Patrick Swayze gives that character, and Michael Paré just kind of walks around. And he's like, I'm gonna punch you in the face now, and then he does it, right? Like that's kind of the character.
Yeah.
I may be wrong, but I think Patrick Swayze was one of the actors that they were trying to get. I know they were trying to get Tom Cruise.
That's right.
And that was like their number one choice. But yeah, I just thought it was funny when he shows up to save his sister's diner from getting vandalized and wrecked. And then he proceeds to throw all the bad guys through the window.
Yeah.
probably causes more damage.
I think my favorite moment, possibly in film history at this point, is the police are in a standoff. The police and the city are in a standoff against the gang. Towards the end of the movie,
yep.
It's like, wait a minute, you know what? We're having trouble handling this. Let's like let Michael Paré go punch Willem Dafoe in the face and see if that solves the problem.
And even better, we're gonna get Bill Paxton and his buddies with shotguns to come out and back him up.
Yeah.
And what weapons were they fighting with? I forgot. They were fighting with weapons.
It's like a sledgehammer fight.
Yeah, right. They were fighting with the little sledgehammers, and then everybody came out. And they all had the same shotgun. It wasn't a pump action. It was with that handle right underneath the trigger that you kind of flicked down. And it made for a really cool visual when they all did it. But
Michael Paré disarms Willem Dafoe. By all accounts, the police should go and arrest Willem Dafoe, and that's the end of the movie.
Nope.
Instead, Michael Paré's like, you know what? I don't need my sledgehammer anymore. So he throws it to the ground. And do they fight? No. He waits for Willem Dafoe to charge him and throw him into a pile of motorcycles.
That's right. It's a great fight. God, I love this movie. I can't believe Jeff is downvoting it. Let's get back to the song here.
You got so many dreams that you don't know.
That's very Jim Steinman. I don't know if you guys listen to a lot of Meatloaf, but and Meatloaf actually did this song same year for his album Bad Attitude. He did it a lot worse, but he actually covered this song.
I just want to state as a healthcare worker that the lyrics are correct. That is how the brain sends messages to your nerves and muscles.
So it's even medically accurate.
Yes, it is.
And sweating buckets and it's not even hot. What's that a sign of, Jeff?
Listening to really good rock and roll music.
Gotcha.
And Jim Steinman on Bad Out of Hell 2 does one of my favorite spoken word songs I've ever heard. Corey, do you remember the name of that song, the one he does off of Bad Out of Hell 2?
Spoken word?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. He does, there's like a poetry slam in the middle of Bad Out of Hell 2. And Steinman, I don't know if he performs it, but it's like all him, basically. Wasted Youth.
I was going to say, it sounds like Wasted Youth, yeah.
Yeah, Wasted Youth, which is like just a spoken word slam kind of poetry.
Interesting. Bat 2 is a great album. Like I think it's on par with Bat 1, which is arguably one of the greatest albums ever recorded, right? Like it's one of the biggest, that's for sure. It's, you know, Jim Steinman made a whole career on that. And, you know, aside from this album and beginning to produce Def Leppard's Hysteria, Jim Steinman did do much else. Yeah, I just want to point out, Meatloaf fans, you're going to recognize lyrics like, and we'll fly away on those angel wings of chrome in your daddy's car, because Jim Steinman loves car songs. Like, Bat Out of Hell is about a motorcycle crash, like the song. You know, it's about dying. He was obsessed with all those old 50 songs where the protagonist, like somebody died in the song, like Last Kiss and songs like that from the 50s, these car crash songs where people died. That's why he wrote Bat Out of Hell, except he did it with a motorcycle. So anytime he references cars and chrome, it's like, oh yeah, that's classic Jim Stein. And there's some great cars in this. We just did a show, John, on Christine. And here we have, instead of a 58 Plymouth Thierry, we got a 51 Mercury. And God, that's a cool looking car.
Yeah, yeah. The cars are badass. I can't believe most of this movie was shot like on a sound stage. I was just reading some of the making of this movie. And it was developed in the wake of 48 Hours. The three producers had worked on 48 Hours, and they got a kind of a bad rap for not having enough women in that movie. So they wanted to go and prove people were wrong. And then they were inspired by the movie Flashdance. And they wanted it to have more of a musical vibe, which is where we get this great soundtrack from. And it's weird because all of the elements that they were throwing into this hodgepodge, really on the surface shouldn't work, but it comes together so effortlessly on the screen, and it works as both a good and bad movie. Like if you want to have a bad movie night at your house, a bad 80s movie at your house, where you can kind of poke fun at the movie a little bit and enjoy some of the elements of it, this is that movie. But also if you just want a good 80s action movie where like it has that old school 80s vibe and everything fits just right, it also fits that movie. Like it works in both worlds.
So John just said it's a perfect movie, and I agree. And speaking of Flashdance, John, the young lady who's dancing on the bar at Torchy's when the Blasters are playing was Jennifer Beals' dance double in Flashdance.
And what's weird is Jeff has been the real life double of Torchy's recently in the real world.
Several times. Yeah, we have a chain of taco restaurants down here called Torchy's. But Jennifer Beals' double was not dancing on the bar when I went there, unfortunately.
Well, that's too bad because she's a very good dancer. Mm-hmm. Wearing her fishnets. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have anywhere to go, go down on the pedal and you're ready to roll. And even if you don't have anywhere to go, Oh man, for me, that pre-chorus and chorus are just, it takes me back to childhood, and I've listened to the song ad nauseum since 1984. I never get sick of it. I love, love, love everything about this song. To me, that's just musical perfection.
Yeah, it's good stuff, man. And this is going on like all through the opening titles of the movie. And what did y'all think about that kind of stylized, like pixelated screen swipe they kept doing?
Oh, I love that. And you know what? And there was no like online editing, no computer editing at that time. They actually had to take a razor blade and cut the emulsion on the film to create that wipe. I watched the making of after I watched the movie. That's how I know that. But that's how things were done in those days. Like, you couldn't just program in on your Adobe suite to do a razor blade wipe. They actually took a razor blade and cut the emulsion and spliced the film together. And that's how it was achieved.
It's pretty cool. I think that's the first time I've ever seen it.
Yeah, it's a really great effect. It's amazing that it's not like we know it couldn't have been digital. It gives it that techno vibe that I guess they were going for, that it doesn't really exist in the 50s or the 80s. It's somewhere kind of in this makeshift alternate universe, and makes it work really well.
I wanted to ask you guys about the production design, because like John alluded to, most of this film was shot on a soundstage. Anything above the train tracks was shot in Chicago. Everything below the train tracks was on a back lot. And normally when you shoot on a back lot, it looks like the back lot, right? But I really loved the design aesthetic of this film. John, what did you think?
Oh, I don't know how low the budget of the movie was, because they were coming off of the success of 48 Hours. But, you know, for the purposes of this movie, they made that soundstage look like a city, you know, an alternate world city. And I miss some of this real world design in modern cinema. Now they just put a giant, whatever they call that giant screen, mm-hmm. that everyone acts in front of, and they create entire worlds around them. And that's all well and good, but there's definitely an art to the production design of this movie.
100%. Jeff?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I didn't, until I was like reading up on it, I didn't really realize that it was all, or the majority of it was on a soundstage. Because they really do sell the illusion very, very well that you're actually on location.
And the budget, John, was $14.5 million, which nowadays doesn't sound like much, but in 84, that was a fair-sized budget.
Yeah, I'm reading up on the, Star Wars was 12 or something, wasn't it?
11 or 12, years yeah. Early?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a reasonable budget for back then. Mm-hmm. They're doing it in the studio system, and they're pulling these actors. I'm reading it now. You know, the goal was that they wanted to get the new Steve McQueen, mm-hmm. and like you said, they had wanted Tom Cruise. They also wanted Eric Roberts for the role. They wanted Patrick Swayze, and they get Michael Paré. Michael Paré hadn't had a movie released yet. They had filmed it, the two movies, like you said, but he's. They also wanted Daryl Hannah over Diane Lane. And I look, all due respect to Daryl Hannah, I think they got very lucky getting that Diane Lane for this movie when they did. Michael Paré was recommended by the same casting agent as Eddie Murphy, because they share the agent at the time. And Catherine Bigelow recommended Willem Dafoe for this movie. Like, the names connected on the outside of this movie show you the careers of the people, like the careers that they're going to end up having going ahead.
Yeah.
But Corey, I'm sorry. I know we should comment on the song before we do. How much was the budget of this movie again?
$14.5 million.
So we were talking about the sets, okay? They built the elevated train, a replica of it, and the brownstones on the set. So that way they could duplicate everything on the set. Okay. They covered it in a tarp so that way they could do day or night. The tarp measured 1,240 feet long by 220 feet wide to cover the set so that way they could do the lighting and everything the way they wanted to do the lighting. Mm-hmm. The tarp cost $1.2 million of that budget.
Can you believe it? And yeah, they wanted to shoot day for night because you don't want to do night shoots for an entire shoot, right? That's just, you know, so someone suggested, let's just put a tarp over the set. And then they had the issue with when it got windy, the tarp would flap and the mics would pick it up and there was pigeons that would roost in the tarp. And so at one point, somebody would literally have to fire a shotgun into the air to scare the pigeons and then they would call action right after. So somebody would yell shotgun, they would fire the gun, pigeons would fly away, Walter Hill would yell action, they would act. The tarp didn't really work.
You said the Meatloaf version of this song sucks because it has everything that makes a good Meatloaf song.
I know.
I could hear him singing this song.
I know, right? I'll play a little bit of the Meatloaf one after, but it just doesn't work as well.
That's kind of amazing because I'm like listening to the bravado that they have, right? Like everything that they're singing. I'm like, this is every element in a great Meatloaf song.
100%. It really should be, but it just doesn't work. Bob Kulick played on it. He performed it live during the Bad Attitude Tour with the Neverland Express, but didn't really play it after that. But yeah, I'll definitely play a little snippet of it here before we finish off here tonight. Because you would think he would knock this out of the park. I want to ask you guys a little bit about Walter Hill as a director. He did The Warriors, which this movie borrows from The Warriors quite a bit. Of course, 48 Hours and its sequel, another 48 Hours. He did Brewster's Millions. You guys ever see that? With Richard Pryor, John Candy?
We're going to do that movie on the show at some point.
Oh, what song?
I'm not sure, but we're going to do it because I love that movie.
I love that movie, too. Red Heat. You guys remember that one? Jim Belushi's in that, isn't he?
So you said The Warriors. Michael Pare's sister from this movie is in The Warriors. I was trying to figure out why. And I guess that makes sense, right? Like, they would pick her up, and she ends up having a pretty solid career after this movie. But she's from The Warriors.
That's right. Yeah. But I tell you what, after, say, 93, he did a movie called Geronimo, an American Legend. After that, didn't really do a lot. Big movies. His last, he did Bullet to the Head. That was a Sylvester Stallone film in 2012. His last credit here is a movie called Dead for a Dollar. Came out in 2022 with Christoph Waltz, Willem Dafoe, and Rachel Brosnahan. Geez, that'd be an interesting film. We should check that out. you guys know there was a sequel to Streets of Fire?
I think I read something about that. I don't know that it was like an official sequel.
That's right. Originally, there were supposed to be three Tom Cody films. Streets of Fire was going to be the first one. The second film is going to be in the snow. The third film is going to be in the desert. And they had titles, but they didn't have stories. But this movie tanked so bad. On a $14.5 million budget, it made $8 million. So that kind of killed all the sequels. But way back in 2008, Albert Pyun, who's a B-movie director, made a lot of crap. Unfortunately, he passed away in 2022, made a movie called Road to Hell, which was inspired by Streets of Fire. It kind of became a de facto sequel to Streets of Fire, starring Michael Paré as Tom Cody and Deborah Van Valkenburgh as Reva, his sister. She came back for this film. They recast Ellen Aim. Anita Lehman played Ellen Aim. Baby Doll, who is from this film, is that character is back, but it's a different actor. I've never seen Road to Hell. I didn't even know this existed until I started watching or researching for the show that there's actually a spiritual sequel to Streets of Fire.
We may have to check that out.
This is not like you've sold me on that one. Like, this movie made me want to rewatch a bunch of great 80s movies. Like, Next to King comes to mind. Roadhouse came to mind. I feel like there is a genre of movie that this gets me excited for. The sequel to this movie, not so much.
No, I agree. And actually, Albert Pyun doesn't make me very excited. He's a B-movie director for a reason. If anyone watches Red Letter Media, they've covered some Albert Pyun movies on their Best of the Worst series because his films are considered pretty gosh darn bad.
Yeah, you know what I would almost like to see happen? You know, we have all these reboots and remakes of movies that were perfect to begin with. This movie has a lot of great elements to it. And I may be moving from The Dream Is Over to What Dreams Are Made Of on this one.
Oh.
We'll see at the end. But I think this movie would be great fodder for like a remake or a reboot and continue out those other stories that were originally intended.
That would be very cool. Who would you guys cast as Tom Cody, as our hero, the man with no name, the Mad Max of the story? Who would be good there? Chris Evans?
No, he's too... It has to be somebody younger. Mm-hmm.
He's got to be somewhat experienced, though. He was a military guy. Just fresh out of the military, pretty much, right?
No, but you're talking like a 20-something-year-old fresh out of the military. Like, he joined... Okay.
Tom Cody was a little older, like in the 30s.
No, because everybody in this movie was supposed to be... they were going for that John Hughes vibe.
Yeah.
But it felt like they were going for that 20-something John Hughes vibe. You know, more along the lines of, can't believe I'm invoking this movie, but like saying Elmo's Fire, right? but those 20 somethings is what they were going for, you know. Clearly, nobody in their 30s, and I think, you know, that's what you got to go for with the actors. You need a good 20 something, fresh faced, tough guy actor.
Yeah, you know, like Nicholas Holt.
He wouldn't be bad.
He played Beast in the new X-Men movies. He was in Mad Max Fury Road.
No, he's a good stoic actor. He has more charisma.
Definitely more charisma. Yeah.
I don't think that's a bad call.
Yeah, I would. I think he's maybe in his 30s though.
I was going to say Tom Holland.
Tom Holland would be good.
Tom Holland would be good.
Yeah.
If we're going for someone in their 30s, I might even go with like a Michael B. Jordan.
Oh, he'd be good. Maybe a little too much charisma.
I almost wouldn't mind Michael B. Jordan in the Willem Dafoe role.
Oh,
there you go.
Oh, man.
There you go.
Bust out the
I got Jeff very excited with that.
The vinyl butcher costume.
How about like an Anya Taylor-Joy as Ellen Aim?
Yeah,
I would like that.
Or Zendaya, if we're gonna have Tom Holland have Zendaya as Ellen.
I wouldn't mind Zendaya, because Zendaya could do the songs for it too.
That's right. She wouldn't have to lip sync. Yeah.
Yeah, you could have Zendaya as her and have Anna Joy Taylor. Did I mess her name up?
Anya Taylor Joy.
Her, The witch. You could have her as the sidekick.
The Amy Madigan character.
Army girl. Yeah.
That's interesting. Oh, this could be prime for a reboot. I really wish they kept the 50s aesthetic, though. To me, that kind of encompasses the world of Streets of Fire. Everyone should drive, like, you know, 51 Mercurys and have the big pompadour hairdos. Like, when I saw Bill Paxton as the bartender come out with that hairdo, I got very happy.
I got instead of Diane Lane, what if you had Zoe Kravitz?
That would work.
Oh, yeah. Daughter of a rock star.
You know, Zoe Kravitz maybe as the Amy Madigan character works, too.
Yeah, yeah.
She's kind of got that edge.
She's tough.
Who plays the Rick Moranis character?
I say you bring Rick Moranis out of retirement.
No one else can touch that role. I like that.
With that part of the movie, don't mess with perfection.
No, you know who I would get is the kid from A Social Network, from Zombieland. What's his name? Not a kid anymore.
Lex Luthor.
Yeah, what's his name?
Eisenberg. Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah.
Jesse Eisenberg, I think, would play that role to perfection.
Yep.
I can absolutely. I definitely can see that.
Oh, we got a movie here, guys. We just got to get a director and screenwriter on board.
I'm thinking we have a series.
I think Tim Miller's your director.
That'd be all right.
Okay. Yeah.
George Miller would be better, but.
and that's the beauty of doing it as a limited series.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about the structure.
Directors.
But I was thinking about the structure of Deadpool. Is that if you do it smaller, like this movie was, on the soundstage and everything, Tim Miller would be very well suited for that.
I don't think he's got much going on either. We should give him a call. Get the rights to Streets of Fire.
You know what? Screw it. Scrap it. You know who I would get? I'm invoking the name, Corey. Are you ready?
Okay. I'm ready.
Lowell Dean.
Lowell would have a field day with Streets of Fire.
Oh, my God. That is perfection.
Give Lowell this cast. And like, if you want a man who's going to invoke that 80s vibe on a movie, but give it its own spin and keep it fun and punchy and relevant, Lowell's your guy.
He's the guy. Absolutely.
And I think that you have to set it in Canada then and make it part of the Wolf Cop universe.
The Wolf Cop cinematic universe.
Yes.
Sometimes you go too far. I just want Lowell to do Streets of Fire straight up as I really feel that's the movie we all deserve.
And
you can have your Wolf Cop 3.
Okay.
Right?
Aru.
Also. Right. Aru. But let him do this.
Let him do this and it'll finance Wolf Cop 3, which he's very stubbornly not making at the moment. We got to help the guy get some financing to make it happen.
I was just say, hopefully the wrestling movie he's making will do well.
Yes, Dark Match with that jerk Chris Jericho. Yeah. Right, that's Nowhere Fast from the film Streets of Fire. Oh, little sorcerer for you. No, I better hit pause. I can listen to the soundtrack all damn day. Produced by Jimmy Iovine, who did a lot of stuff with Tom Petty back in the day. Tracks written by Jim Steinman. We already talked about the other acts on here. Tom Petty wrote a song. The Blasters have a couple of songs. pitch perfect soundtrack for a really wonderful 80s movie. We got a couple of minutes left, guys. I'm going to play a little bit of Meatloaf's version of Nowhere Fast, released in 1984. And already it's worse. See, like, what the fuck is that?
It's rough. Yeah, but that's the production. That's not Meatloaf.
That's true.
If you have layered Meatloaf over the original track, it'd be gold.
Absolutely. I always hated that part. So synthy. Different lyrics, was, too.
The production on this is horrible.
Yeah.
And this actually came out on a record?
It really did. The album Bad Attitude, which is one of Meatloaf's worst, if you ask me. The completely different lyrics.
Yeah, and it would have sounded weird with this coming out of Diane Lane's mouth.
And imagine people in the crowd trying to be excited about a song. They're not getting excited about this.
No, I don't think so.
Let's see if the chorus is any better.
Stop it.
I want to hear the chorus.
So bad.
I know, right? But here's the chorus. So that's not bad.
Yeah, but he gets kind of lost in the mix.
Yeah.
Like he's not up enough in the mix.
Yeah. You can tell Jim Steinman had nothing to do really with this album. He wrote a few tracks on it, Nowhere Fast and a song called Surf's Up. Produced by Alan Shacklock. I don't know. I prefer the Streets of Fire version myself.
Yeah, same here. Do you know, so earlier we mentioned that Horner was going to be the composer, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, do you know for the title sequence, this was not the original song they had in mind? They were...
For the beginning of the movie or the end of the movie? Because I know at the end of the
beginning.
Movie... Okay, I know in the end of the movie they had a Bruce Springsteen song in mind. But.
Oh, maybe I'm... No, I well, that's what I'm talking about, but I thought I'd read it was for the beginning.
No, it was for the end. They actually shot an entire end covering Bruce Springsteen's Streets of Fire, assuming they could get the rights. And then they couldn't get the rights, so they went to Jim Steinman and said, you got to write us something. And he wrote a song in 2 days, and that song became Tonight Is What It Means to Be Young, which is another great Jim Steinman song. And then they had to reshoot that whole ending. And you could tell Diane Lane's wearing a wig because she already had shorter hair for another project. Had to put a wig on during the reshoots. But yeah, they thought, we'll get the rights. And Bruce Springsteen originally gave them the rights to the song Streets of Fire.
Right.
But when he heard somebody else would be singing it, it wouldn't be his version. He pulled the rights.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting. But I got confused. I thought it was for the opening.
No, and I only know that because I watched the documentary on the 4K Blu-ray, which just came out from Shout Factory. Definitely worth picking up, even just for the making of documentaries, because the making of this film is pretty interesting. But they talk pretty generously about, we shot the whole ending with Streets of Fire, thinking we had the rights, and then Bruce Springsteen said, fuck you. And so they had it, Jim Steinman, write us a song. So he wrote a song in 2 days, and then they said, well, fuck you, Jim Steinman. This is a great song. We have to reshoot the ending. And then they reshot the entire ending.
Yeah, and I did read that the studio then said that the Bruce Springsteen song was too depressing, and that's why they...
Yeah, and it is a very depressing song. Yeah, kind of not what you want for your big uplifting finale. But
it all worked out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we got you, Jeff. What are your final thoughts on Streets of Fire? Have you leaned more towards what dreams are made of, or this dream is over?
Do you have it queued up, Corey?
I don't, because it's a different show. That's a thumbs up. Jeff is upvoting it now. That's awesome. Did we convince you? What was it that finally swayed you to the good side?
Oh, everything that's not Michael Paré.
But he's so bad he's good in a way.
He is.
He has the presence of that character. He just doesn't have the chops to pull it.
He has the look. I just don't think he was quite, and maybe he never was, mature enough as an actor to pull off the role. But there's so much good stuff in this. And even, you know, despite his lack of actability, that's a word. It's still good. It really does tap into like a whole genre of movies, like John was saying earlier, that I totally want to sit down and binge watch tonight.
Oh, I agree. And did you like the song?
Yes. I'm definitely going to download this because I need to hear it more.
Good, man. Download the whole soundtrack. There's not a bad song on it. John, what are your final thoughts on Streets of Fire and Nowhere Fast?
I think it's essential 80s watching. Like if you want to claim to be a child of the 80s and you want to claim to enjoy 80s flicks, this is one of them that needs to be in your library. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Everything good and bad about this movie deserves to be celebrated. And the soundtrack is the bomb.
100%. Could not agree more. And those are perfect words to end on. Jeff, while we got you here, why don't you tell the folks where they can find you? And do you have anything cool coming up?
Let's see. I am at Jeff Saunders 74. I think I got it right this time. On the Instagrams and on the Twitters, and I'm working on something. It's still in the early stages, but there's going to be a new channel launching at some point called Crypto Currently, and it's going to be like a podcast version of like a tabloid magazine, kind of. But it'll go deep into all the crazy kooky stuff that I adore, whether it's cryptids, conspiracy theories, UFOs, ghosts, all the good stuff.
Oh, that's perfect. Be on the lookout for that. John, anything you want to promote here before we call it a night?
Sure. I'll promote Backtracks, Aerosmith Revisited with Scott K. Haskin and Corey Morissette. We are recapping the entire Aerosmith catalog. We're a little over 50 songs in right now and enjoying the hell out of it. So if you enjoy this show, maybe you'll enjoy that show. Go and give us some love over there. And by all means, if you're supporting us over there, please come over here and support us on this show.
There you have it. And as always, we are a proud member of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. Go check out all of our sister shows on www.deepdivepodcastnetwork.com. We got a show there for everybody, I swear. There's a lot of great stuff on there. But until next time, on behalf of Jeff Saunders and John Mariano, my name is Corey Morissette. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time on Backtracks Theme Music.
Well, looks like I finally ran into someone that likes to play as rough as I do.
Yeah, this must be your lucky night.
I'm lucky? I guess maybe I am. And you're dumb. Real dumb if you think you can pull this off.
I think you're forgetting something. I got the gun.
I can get guns, smart guy, lots of them. Now why don't you tell me your name?
Tom Cody. Pleased to meet you.
I'll be coming for her. And I'll be coming for you, too.
Sure you will. And I'll be waiting.